The views expressed on The Final Straw do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bursa Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. This show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you'd like to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full calendar of events and a link to some of their catalog of books and zines can be found online at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week, Burr spoke with a member of the No New OC Jail campaign, opposing the construction of a new Orange County jail in Central North Carolina. During the conversation, the organizer talks about prison abolition, community organizing, mental health, the ecological claims of the proposed construction company, greenwashing, and how the jail fits into the process of gentrification going on in Orange County, North Carolina. We also touch on the intersections of race and class in terms of incarceration and briefly speak about alternatives to sticking people in cages. Want to learn more about this campaign and join in? You can email them at nonewocjail@gmail.com. That's nonewocjail@gmail.com. And their phone number is 919-335-6848. That's 919-335-6848. Or you can find them on Fedbook by searching No New OC Jail, where you can find out more, including their petition to block the construction of the jail in Hillsboro, North Carolina. After that, we'll be hearing an interview with Alex Holtz, a student involved in the Fees Must Fall, a student movement in South Africa, from the amazing anarchist video project It's the End of the World When We Know It and I Feel Fine, which is available from submedia.tv. In the conversation, Alex explains popular student responses to austerity measures in their schools, futures, and lives, with continued ratcheting down of neoliberal capitalist policies imposed by the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, party. Alex talks about recent student riots, overlaps with other social movements, intersections in post-apartheid South Africa between class and race and age, and the struggles being engaged in.
But first, this announcement from Certain Days. The Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners Calendar Collective, which can be found at www.certaindays.org, is releasing its 16th calendar in the fall of 2016. Over the years, they've turned their attention to various themes: grassroots organizing, resisting oppression, and visions of justice. The theme for 2017 is focused on what it takes to sustain our movements. We are looking for 12 works of art and 12 short articles to feature in the calendar, which hangs in more than 2,000 homes, workplaces, prison cells, and community spaces around the world. They encourage contributors to submit both new and existing work, and the deadline for submission is March 15th of 2016. For further information, such as submission guidelines, format, and so on, you can visit this project's website at certaindays.org and follow the links on the left-hand side of the page to call for submissions. But before Burst's interview with the No New OC Jail campaign, I'd like to give just an update on the prisoner uprisings in Holman in Alabama. This is from itsgoingdown.org. Quote, "Things here are tense but festive. The CO and warden was stabbed. It has nothing to do with overcrowding, but with the practice of locking folks up for profit, control, and subjugation. Fires were set. We got control of two cubicles, busted windows. The riot team came, shot gas, locked down, and searched the dorms. Five have been shipped and two put in lockup," said a prisoner at Holman Correctional. This week, prison rebels at Holman Correctional Facility in Atmore, Alabama, staged 2 riots in 3 days, battling guards, building barricades, stabbing the warden, taking over sections of the prison, and setting a guard station on fire. These actions come as no surprise to those who've been paying attention to the crumbling prison system in Alabama and the increasing level of radicalization of the prison population there. The uprising at Holman and the conditions of Alabama prisons in general provide a unique situation in which anarchist solidarity may prove strategic. Historically speaking, successful prison uprisings have often been the result of a degrading prison system, incompetence, understaffing, weak administration, in combination with a high level of prisoner unity and the development of a strong political subculture within the prison that supports and encourages acts of resistance. These conditions shift the balance of power between prisoners and their captors and allow prisoners more latitude to take bold action. Prison rebels in Alabama report that guards often refuse to enter the cell blocks for months at a time out of fear of attacks. The conditions for rebellion are ripe in the Alabama prison system. The conditions that Alabama prison rebels and anarchists outside of prisons have cultivated over the years have created a situation in which expressions of solidarity from anarchists may have an impact. There is a great possibility that news of solidarity actions will reach prisoners there, and that those actions will make sense to these rebels. Another way in which anarchist solidarity may prove uniquely valuable in this and other situations of prison rebellion is in our capacity to relate to these uprisings outside the framework of reform that the media, the state, and the left will inevitably push them toward. We are already hearing the rhetoric of those outside Holman turning immediately toward reform, appeals to legitimacy in hopes of reaching journalists and liberals, and framing the riots as a last resort after nonviolent methods failed. In the spirit of diversity of tactics, we've compiled a list of some ways to act in solidarity with prison rebels in Alabama. The intention of the list is to find ways to act in solidarity with the many, often contradictory desires of the many different rebels involved in the uprising. And to find a list of those things that you can do, which we do not have time to list out here, you can visit the news source itsgoingdown.org/call-action-solidarity-alabama-prison-rebels for more creative ways to get involved.
We're speaking with an activist from the No New OC Jail campaign opposing the new Orange County Jail in central North Carolina, which would cost $20 million and replace the existing facility built in 1925. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation.
Yeah, for sure.
Can you tell listeners why you're opposing the new OC Jail?
Yeah, so actually the new jail is going to, before that, is going to cost closer to $30 million, according to their updated budget. So it's going to be even more than predicted before. But the reason that we're opposing the new jail, so we sort of take an abolitionist stance where we dream of a world without people in cages. And one step in that dream is to stop building more jails, detention centers or prisons of any sort. And a lot of that really has to do with our thinking is around ties of racial and capitalistic violence and history around that and current jails. For example, right now, even though Orange County has 12% population of Black folks, but the folks who are actually in Black folks who are in jail make up 54% of the jail. So obviously it's very, very disproportionate. And it's not that we want equal opportunity penal system. We really want an end to jail overall. And we know its purpose and we oppose it because it's very racist, very capitalistic in their way that they round up people and put them in jails and the way they contain people. Because most of the folks who are rounded up are low-level offenders. So they get put in for drug charges or something, or even just for being homeless. So we don't really want a nicer jail, bigger jail. We don't want any of that. We just don't want any jails overall. Also, it's a result of a revitalization of the triangle where they're pushing out tons of poor white, black, and brown individuals, not funding housing, but instead spent this $30 million, which most of it is funded by debt, into building this new jail because they want to contain these folks. They may not explicitly say that, but from the trend that they have been incarcerating folks, that's we predict that will be the case as well. So they're adding these 90 beds. Possibly, for the most part, these beds will be for mostly for working class black and brown folks. But that's kind of like run through of our reasons.
For folks that may not understand just may not understand some of the intersections between class mm-hmm. and race and how they mm-hmm. enact in the U.S. carceral mm-hmm. system, yeah, yeah. Can you break down how that works and why systemically it comes out that in an area where only 12% of the population is African-American, 54% of the people that are in the jail are black?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So a lot of the research that we've done really has to go back through to the abolition of slavery back in the 13th Amendment. So that was passed mostly most well-known for abolition of slavery. But there's a clause in it that most people don't see, we don't really study, is that no one should be enslaved unless they're like criminals or something. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing this, but there's a clause that basically says that. So in many ways, we would say that slavery hasn't really been abolished in the sense that they turned into prisons. Because what happened after that was passed is that a lot of folks were re-enslaved by being contained into prisons and jails. So this process started through that since then and continues through now. And especially with the Orange County Jail, in which Hillsborough is like a lot of sheriffs and a lot of officials I know within the jail have history in the KKK, a lot of them are Klan members. So that's also another way in which it has been very much racialized, especially toward black folks. And nowadays with police, they also were more likely to stop black folks. And a lot of times for folks who are like Latinx or it seems like racially non-white or black or Asian tend to be slotted into white. So sometimes when you see the stats that they provide in prisons and jails, you actually can't even segregate. You can't even split out people from the white category into. So it's like a very complex process in which how they process this. And just even from their own data, you can see more black and brown folks are being incarcerated. And sometimes because of documentation that will mostly be applied for Latinx and Asian folks. So a lot of that history really has to tie back to slavery, especially for black folks. And for Latinx, undocumented folks, it's border politics in which undocumented folks are detained, usually racially profiled by police officers. So a lot of that is like through that sort of colonial and imperial history that eventually tied into, built into this like prison system to contain these folks. So.
And the term that you're using for people of Latin American descent, Latinx, is that like the mm-hmm. gender non-specific plural?
Yeah. Generally, so like it's like Latino and Latina, but also taking into trans folks and queer folks. Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. I've seen folks in Spanish use at signs or X's, and I know that's a big thing in Mexico right now. But cool.
Right.
I hadn't heard it pronounced.
That's like how I've heard it pronounced, but yeah.
So the new proposed jail for Orange County is claiming to be more energy efficient and ecologically sustainable. That's one of the selling points that at least one of the initial reports requesting the mm-hmm. funds and the planning for the new facility, that's what it was pushing. Can you talk about that, like kind of like the greenwashing of the prison system?
Yeah, exactly, right. That was like the main thing that I was going to talk about. They are really proposing it to be more environmentally friendly, and the architects, mostly architects who are building the jail, are like advertising that. They're like known for being environmentally friendly. And it's interesting because in an area like Chapel Hill Carborough, they're very into this like green anything because a lot of white liberals are really into that idea, so they get a lot of buy-in. So it's interesting how they're advertising that because they almost saying, oh yeah, because this facility is more environmentally friendly, it's better than the old facility, but it's not getting into underlying issue of incarceration. I mean, it's still, no matter how much better, whatever that means for the jail, people are still incarcerated. They're still trapped in this cage. So And it's interesting because I think it's a safe issue, like environmentalism is a safe issue that people can approach because they don't really have to think about race or capitalism or colonialism. Even though, ironically enough, environmentalism, I would say, is like very much rooted in racism, capitalism, and colonialism. So it's just kind of interesting how that's approached as a key point. But yeah, they're definitely trying to advertise it based on that to give more support because people tend to be very much supportive of something like that, even though incarceration itself is the key issue here.
Yeah, it seems like a crazy deflection point for a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so the folks that are listening, I should ask you to point out, but can you talk about like just the generalized like overview situation of Orange County, North Carolina, so that listeners in other parts of the country might understand like what cities are there, what industries, class components?
So Orange County, North Carolina. So generally, so this jail is going to be built in Hillsborough. Because current jail is in Hillsborough, downtown Hillsborough currently. But the new jail is going to be built off, like, not in downtown, which is also another interesting point. It's going to be off somewhere where people can't really see. So they're trying to reduce the visibility of this jail to revitalize. So there's a lot of revitalization going on in the county right now, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Hillsborough, all these places in Orange County are getting revitalized, quote-unquote, which this is, I think, seen as part of that revitalization process because when people see it, it's unsightly to have a jail. Oh, no, we don't want to see criminals, like, downtown running around, that sort of mentality. Because recently in Chapel Hill, actually, the homeless shelter, the men's homeless shelter that is downtown got moved a little bit further away where people can't see it as much. And that used to be Chapel Hill's jail. So that's kind of interesting how it turned from a jail into a homeless shelter and now moved again out of sight. So they're really trying to revitalize this place. And in one of the Board of Commissioners meetings, who are the decision-making body for this new jail, one of the guys even joked about how they should turn the old jail into a bread and breakfast or something like that, which is really sick that they're laughing about this. but yeah, that's kind of the situation in Orange County, and the background behind the jail is this like revitalization idea. Yeah.
So probably a huge center of the. I mean, so the Chapel Hill Carrboro is a part of the triangle, and it seems like been a boom in tech and biotech right over the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. So when you're using the term revitalization, which sounds like one of, like, it's a capitalist term that's sort of saying what it really means, but it making the area more welcoming for outside investment,
mm-hmm,
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like, to be really blunt, they're making the area more more pleasing to, like, middle-class white people. Like, for the most part, that's, like, really what they're trying to get at, because, like, you're trying to see. So in Chapel Hill, that's already kind of happened for the most part. In Carrboro, where I live, I can still kind of see how folks are getting, because a lot of Latinx folks live in Carrboro, not visibly, but they do live in Carrboro. And you're kind of seeing them getting pushed out a little bit, like, in this process. And in Hillsborough, I think that has already happened to a pretty large extent, but they're not as, Hillsborough's not as, like, I feel like it's, in general, it's not as as wealthy as the Chapel Hill area, so it's a little bit different dynamics, too. So in all these cities, kind of in Orange County, revitalization, quote-unquote, is happening, and the really meaning of it is, like, gentrification and push out of Black and brown folks, especially when they're poor. So that's kind of like our translation of revitalization. That obviously doesn't get talked about really in these meetings or anything like that.
Yeah. So the interests that are being promoted aren't for the existent people that are living there, but with the hopes of pushing them out and making space for people that are going to be paying more taxes and bringing in more upscale donut shops and crap like that.
Right, exactly. Which has actually just happened in Carrboro. So there's some like donut shop that opened.
Oh, no.
but yeah.
So the new jail also promotes itself as offering more mental health care for the incarcerated folks there. Can you talk about mental health care and incarceration in Orange County and also in the U.S. in general?
Yeah, this is kind of interesting because we didn't really even have a lot of information about this more mental health care, aside from the fact that it can have more light in this new building. I don't really know what that means, like what does it mean, like more light as in for everyone? So they were very vague about this. And often I feel like their perception of mental health care is not really beneficial for those who are inside. Like Rick talked about how people are usually put in turtle suits to prevent suicide, which is that's what they consider as mental health service, which is really not a really effective, like not a great way for folks to recover from mental health. There was a Durham County jail recently, Matthew McCain, who died because he couldn't afford an anger management class that costs $100 a week. So even if they have these services, it will cost money, and he eventually died because he wasn't able to, he was jailed because he couldn't make it to probation, and he violated his probation, and because of the class, so eventually he died because of medical neglect. So there's a lot of that going on within the jails where they think that providing mental health is a certain type of service, but really it's not helping any individuals. So even if they're going to put in services in place, which they haven't specified, we are pretty skeptical, I think, of these services just from the past experiences of jails around the area. And I guess U.S. as a whole, I don't know. I don't think we've ever really looked into it specifically as a whole. But even just thinking about mental health, like in a jail in general, like you have folks who are locked up. So how do you even improve mental health for them? Like it's like very reformist in that sense. It's like, oh, we're going to lock you up, but we're going to provide some mental health issues. But a lot of these issues stem from being locked up. So it's just, the logic doesn't really add up there. And it usually, by locking folks up, you're exacerbating mental health issues. So, and even if you have like reformist programs, they might be helpful, but they ultimately would not make incarceration any better for these folks. So especially since police staff, jail officials often exert so much control over their lives that, and often in violent ways that we don't even know about and aren't spoken of because there have been jail deaths and there's no information released for them. So I think for us, even the idea of improving mental health is not really possible within the context of incarceration. So.
Well, yeah. You were mentioning Matthew McCain having to pay $100 a week for an a court-appointed anger management class. Like, it seems like there's overlap or like a point of context when there's not affordable or free mental health care services and counseling available to the public, and then incarceration becomes the response to people's needs of living in an alienated society or just whatever chemical things they have going on. Within their brains, that the response, instead of building a counseling service that's meant to provide services to the public and make sure that people are doing okay in their daily life and being able to function within this world, instead incarcerating them and then offering them services inside is the response. It's a really sick way of looking at public health.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, even if they do provide these services, it costs money, which makes no sense. Like, $100 a week is a lot of money, and he was required to go to that, or else he would be put in jail. So it just, none of that really makes sense if you're trying to help someone. So I don't think they really have that in mind, given so many of these services cost so much money, even alone, like, even besides the fact that they might not even be helpful.
And then when the services get instituted, like in the Durham County system, because we talked recently with folks from Inside Outside. They were talking about the inaccessibility of the services inside, and also if a complaint comes up around the quality of the services or the accessibility of it, the fact is that the company that provides the services is a private company that's contracted with the county that's based out of Kentucky, I think, in the case of the Durham County Jail that offers the health care there. Mm-hmm. So there's no like direct accountability, but there is the parceling up and monetization of this quote-unquote service.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they definitely tied that, all the corporations kind of tied together into that too. So, yeah. Definitely not helpful.
Yeah.
But anyways, the way that they set it up. So,
can you talk a little bit about if Orange County is a participant in Secure Communities and what that is and what that means for undocumented communities in Central North Carolina?
Yeah, so I believe that Orange County is a participant in Secure Communities that last time that I looked it up. And so Secure Communities is like a two-way program. So detention officers kind of fingerprint anyone coming to the Orange County Jail, and this goes into a database. And the officer can get the ID info, location, individual, all that. And that will go to federal officials. But the choice... So having this program supposedly protect undocumented folks, because instead of just automatically putting these folks in jail, what will happen is that this information will go to federal officials like ICE, like immigration, and they can choose to follow up on the person or not. So the choice is up to federal officials and not up to Orange County. So that's the program. And in terms of for undocumented folks in this area, I think it's tricky because even though Orange County seems to pride itself on having this program, they're like, oh, we're protecting immigrants. But I feel like undocumented folks are still profiled and still likely to be detained, maybe not for immigration reasons explicitly, but I feel like they're still profiled in this area. So I feel like, and also the jail data does not break racial categories into Latinx, but I think they're grouped into white. So you have Asian, Black, and White as categories. So we can't also split the data up, which makes it hard for us to even see what is the rate of Latinx folks getting incarcerated. And a lot of folks in this area, undocumented folks, are Latinx. Some might be Asian, Southeast Asian, but that I'm not really familiar with. And because of this like racist carceral system, I wouldn't be surprised if they are detained more. And they're also more vulnerable given they're undocumented. So they're probably more likely to be coerced into doing things. And also, I mean, Orange County still sends all their information to ICE. And so this information is still there and provided, so they can easily detain these folks. So I don't really think the secure community program is like all that helpful. And in terms of expanded facility, they can definitely lock up more folks into the system if they really wanted to, maybe not for solely immigration reasons, but even the system itself is still sending all this information to federal authorities who can detain undocumented folks. So they're not really that safe.
And so this new facility is basically tripling the amount of beds for Orange County, right? Inside and like prison beds. Is it going from, because the article that I'm seeing is saying it's going up to 144 inmate spaces, which is nearly a 90 inmate increase in capacity.
Yes. That's the official number they released. We've like looked at some conflicting numbers and it's like kind of confusing because they never seem to have a very specific number. The ones that we see consistently is the one that you're talking about, like 144 beds, adding 90 beds type of deal. So they're adding quite a lot of beds. So, and it's also interesting because they're adding these beds, but in their own data, they said that the number of folks who are arrested is actually going down. So I'm like, that makes no sense. So the people who are arrested are going down, and you're increasing the number of beds. There's just like not a clear reason as to why they're doing this. They say that it makes the community more safe as one of their goals, but it doesn't make sense when the number of people who are arrested is actually going down. So that's like could be speculated as to who these 90 beds will be devoted to.
Yeah. So in terms of an abolitionist perspective, and Say we're assuming that 30 million is coming out of other things, right? That 30 million is just sitting there and it could be spent on one thing or another. What alternatives to incarceration and the mindset that centers on incarceration as really important for public safety, like what alternatives do y'all from the No New OC Jail campaign propose?
In terms of alternatives to jail specifically?
Yeah, like if the money were to go somewhere else, that would maybe sort of like be applied still towards some of the grievances that people are going to look at and say like, oh, well, we need a jail because of, you know, X, Y, and Z things that are happening in our community. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of it is we really want to abolish cash bail. Some of these alternatives are more so like almost reformist, but not in there, if that makes any sense. But yeah, so especially cash bail, because the problem is that, and court fees, these things really restrict people from being, they're just like detained in jail because they can't afford to pay bail and things like that, even though they might not even have been responsible for anything. So I think that was one of the biggest challenges for a lot of folks who are detained, especially if they're lower offenders. And also ban quality of life violations that put homeless folks in jail. Yeah, especially with like criminalization of homeless folks. So we see that as a larger process, as part of the larger process as well. And maybe some sort of program for community mediation and resolution. We don't know exactly what that would look like, but that's some of the things that we've like looked up as part of alternative. Yeah, we definitely don't believe that reforms like cash bail, court fees will be the end of it. But I think those will be some really helpful alleviating factors for current folks who are incarcerated or who will be incarcerated. So I think those are some of the things we want to devote that money to. But also even just like be able to fund housing in the area, affordable housing, because they got this $30 million. Why are they not putting this into housing? Especially like when we looked up the Board of Commissioners who are making decisions in this, one of them is like Mark Dorison is like very, very into like affordable housing, like all over his page. And I'm like, why isn't this money going into affordable housing, which a lot of folks are having trouble with, which would like really help homeless folks currently and not push them out. So I think they don't really have that in mind, but that would be really great if part of that money can go into affordable housing as well, because it will actually house people, will give them a place to live and all that. So I think those are some of the things we really want to see, especially since there's such a huge housing crisis in Orange County, like places like Chapel Hill, especially since students are moving in and landlords prefer them as opposed to folks who they see as like criminals. So those are some of the ideas we've been circling around with. So,
Cool. What sort of organizing have you all been doing around blocking the facility? Can you talk about successes and obstacles that you've come across so far?
Yeah. So we're really getting started in many ways. We've been outreaching to local communities, both physically and through social media. We've been mostly focused through physical outreach, just knocking on doors and actually talking to people about it. We also had our first community meeting on February 27th, where we, after we did the outreach, that was the point of it, was get folks out to this community meeting so that people can learn more about the jail. We also came up with a petition recently that people can sign online, and we're hoping to do more physical outreach to push out the petition for folks who don't really go online as much. Our successes is that a lot of people really don't know anything about the new jail being built. There's like lack of transparency in this decision, because this was like decided quite a couple years ago, but we didn't even find out until pretty recently. And even Hillsborough, where it's going to be built, like there's not that much information. And when we were trying to like push out a lot of this information, a lot of our flyers got taken off immediately. So obviously they don't really want us to be advertising this. And the poor working class communities in Orange County are being systemically locked up. But they're not aware that this new jail is being built, and they're the ones who probably will be most likely affected. So we're really glad that we're able to go out to those communities and reach out to them and talk to them about it, because they were really receptive. Most of them were like, yeah, we're against the jail, signing up to learn more about this information. So I think that's something we've been pretty successful in. In terms of obstacles, yeah, I think it's really difficult to get people out to our first meeting, just because of transportation, and it was a Saturday, so a lot of people were out doing things. So it was really hard to do that, and just the volumes of research coordination that it takes, because only a couple of us, was it how many of us, like four or five of us really doing a lot of the work. So it's been challenging having so much research to be done, so that we have some credibility to know this information. But yeah, so those are some of the things that we've been doing.
That's a lot. I mean, like, having conversations with folks door to door is a really intimidating thing to do, but really powerful.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but people were very welcoming. So I think I've never had such, like, good experience talking to people, because I guess usually because I've done outreach mostly with, like, college students. So, and if I talk to them about this, I feel like most of the response is like, but we need a jail, though. Like, so, yeah, I'm like, I don't even know where to begin. But I think it's because these folks are very much affected by this issue. So to them, it's like, oh, yeah, of course, a new jail will be terrible. So I think it's just the fact that it resonates with them and something that it really is relevant to their lives. So I think that's why I made it a little easier. But yeah, that's been something that I've really appreciated, just talking to folks about it.
The conversations that I've had around prison abolitionism have like, it tends to stick so much in the theoretical realm, or feel like it has to. Mm-hmm. Like, and mm-hmm. for folks to have enough, like, well, I mean, it sucks that they have enough, like, relationship to the carceral state that they're like, oh, right, this is, you know, what I impact or impacts me. It's important that you're talking about, you know, bail debts and things like that. The fact that people can mm-hmm. imagine alternatives, and not only can, but know that for their own survival, it's necessary to.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with people can't even imagine a world without jails or, like, carceral, like, institutions. Because it seems like it has been in place since forever, but it really hasn't. I think the fact that we reminding people, especially people who aren't really affected by incarceration, that, hey, this hasn't always existed. If anything, this hasn't existed for that long. So we don't really have this. So I think having that conversation is, like, pretty enlightening in some ways, because it's like, oh, wow, yeah, like, it's possible because we didn't live with that. It's like talking about capitalism. It's like, yeah, this hasn't existed for that long. So it's possible to not have it. Just the possibility, I think, makes the those conversations, like, keep going.
How can folks that are maybe hearing this conversation and hearing about the work that you're trying to do for the first time, how can they engage with your organizing? And do you have any, like, upcoming events or public discourses, anything like that?
Yeah, so we're trying to plan more meetings eventually, but right now it's just been kind of tough because of our first meeting took a lot of effort, and we're still trying to coordinate having first meetings. But if folks are interested, they can contact us through email and phone numbers. Our email is nonewocjail@gmail.com. Again, nonewocjail@gmail.com. And our phone number is 919-335-6848. So that's 919-335-6848, and we're happy to talk to you about this issue. We also have a Facebook page, and that is No New Orange County Jail, and you can like us on the page. But also, if you are against this, you can't sign a petition. So we have one online, but you can access it through our Facebook page. So.
And have you gotten any, besides flyers being taken down, which is kind of hard to point out who exactly does that, have you gotten any response from, like, county commissioners or any of the bodies that would be responsible for, like, implementing the new jail?
Yeah, so we are currently in the process of writing letters to them. So originally I really wanted to talk to Mark Dorison, who is, like, a pretty popular candidate, it seems like, because he's known for being, like, progressive and stuff, but Yes. And he's like really into this whole housing thing, affordable housing thing. And recently he had an event, but we weren't able to make it on time to talk to him. So that was a shame. But we're definitely planning on emailing them at the very least to talk to them about this issue and see if they're willing to sign a petition. We're also trying to do more research into exactly how this was started in terms of like who had the idea, because it seems like both the board of commissioners and the sheriff, both of them had some sort of say in this. So we were definitely trying to contact them and see what they think about it and if their reasoning was for supporting them, more clear reasons than currently. So those are definitely something in our minds in the process.
So Mark Dorson likes fedoras, huh?
Sorry,
I'm just looking up on this website right now, and I'm like, oh, there's a...
he's interesting. He's interesting because he's also part of the UNC Civil Rights Center. So, yeah, I don't know. He's interesting because I looked over his page, and I was like, okay, we can push this guy possibly. Maybe he's against it or something. So we're trying to definitely push him pretty hard because he seems to be the most amenable person possibly to this, given that he would be pretty contradictory to his whatever social justice goals if he's like for this jail. Like, it honestly not make sense for him to be for this jail, but who knows. And we're also we're definitely trying to push him, but but also kind of like will he really support us though? I don't know. But we're definitely want to reach out just to see what they say, at least. Especially with like election round, it's like pretty great to be able to at least talk to them about it. So, and we're planning on going to more Board of Commissioners meetings because they have public meetings every month, I think twice a month at least. The last time that we went, when they were talking about jails, it was one of the commissioners brought up the whole like bread and breakfast thing, and it was really gross to see that because how can you joke about that? The people who are incarcerated in cages. So we're definitely planning on going to more of those meetings to see what is coming up next. And they're constantly working on this. So it'll be good to catch those meetings.
In terms of this campaign, are there any prior campaigns that you've looked to for inspiration or for ideas?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the folks who first started this campaign, so I wasn't into the initial process. I got looped in right after when it first got started. With my friends, they were really involved with Inside Outside Alliance that you mentioned in Durham. And I've been to a lot of their jail protests and well, so I know generally what they're doing. So I think a lot of it really comes from them because Durham County Jail has been really just all over the place, and with the lockback and recent deaths uncovered and all of that. So we're really inspired by that. And hearing about the new jail is like, in Orange County, it's like, okay, now we're like local in this area. We can push it from this side as well. So a lot of our stuff has also been taken from them and a lot of information. But definitely a lot of the research had to be done specifically for Orange County. But in terms of inspiration, definitely came a lot from them.
Next up is a segment from the episode of It's the End of the World, We Know It, and I Feel Fine, available from submedia.tv, entitled Fees Must Fall, about recent student riots and organizing in South Africa against the ANC-imposed austerity, state repression, and resistance at the intersections of youth, race, and class in defense of affordable education and much, much more.
Last October, so-called South Africa was rocked by a powerful student movement, which paralyzed the country with 3 weeks of intense protests sparked by a proposed tuition increase. Under the banner of Fees Must Fall, thousands of pissed-off students stormed the parliamentary precinct in Cape Town and marched on the headquarters of the African National Congress, or ANC, in Durban and Johannesburg. This wave of struggle culminated on October 23rd, when tens of thousands of protesters rallied outside the office of the country's corrupt neoliberal strongman, Jacob Zuma, throwing down with the pigs and torching several porta-potties. Faced with the protesters' unwavering determination and the sheer f***ing size of the crowds, Zuma backed down.
There will be a zero increase of university fees.
But rather than settling for this minor concession, student organizers have kept their eye on the motherfucking prize, namely free universal education and an end to the deep structural racism that continues to divide the nation into haves and have-nots. Despite the fall of apartheid in 1994, South Africa remains one of the most economically polarized countries on earth. In fact, under the ANC, inequality has only gotten worse. Almost 80% of its population are indigenous Africans, yet, thanks to the nation's colonial history, whites still own over 70% of the f***ing land. And despite being the second largest economy in Africa, millions of its inhabitants live in sprawling rural slums, struggling to survive on less than a dollar per day.
Life is very rough. There are more than 40 of us sharing one toilet and a tap.
Zuma has been on the ropes since 2013, after it was discovered that he spent tons of public skrilla on opulent renovations to his casa. In recent months, a growing movement has been calling for him to be impeached and for an end to the ANC's 22-year rule. So, within this context of political crisis, the student movement exploded back on the scene in mid-February to remind peeps that shit is still on. On February 15th, students at the University of Cape Town erected a corrugated tin shack on campus to highlight the lack of affordable housing available for students. Pigs responded with flashbang grenades, which kicked things off. Militants soon torched two vehicles, including a university shuttle bus, then proceeded to engage the popo in pitched street battles late into the night. On February 22nd, student and campus workers at the University of Free State disrupted a school rugby match to demonstrate their opposition to staff outsourcing and to show solidarity with striking workers. Soon after the disruption, a mob of white spectators swarmed the field and began attacking the protesters in a gross display of racist violence. 2 days later, at the Northwest University in Mafeking, the school administrator appointed a new student representative council after dissolving the previous one for being too f***ing radical. In the protest that followed, a private security guard opened fire with live ammunition, with some reports suggesting that a student was killed. In response, militants torched several campus buildings, leading to a total suspension of classes. At the time of this writing, protests are continuing in numerous universities across the country and show no signs of stopping anytime soon. To learn more about this situation, I recently caught up with Alex Hutz, a member of Roads Must Fall, a grassroots student group that came together in March of 2015 and which has been a major force in the student movement ever since. Hey Alex, how the f*** are you?
It's a very loaded question. I'm surviving.
For viewers who might not know, who was Cecil Rhodes and why do people want his statue removed from the University of Cape Town campus?
Cecil John Rhodes is a symbol of white supremacy. He was a colonizer. He was one of the first British governors in colonized South Africa. And he plundered the resources of this country, genocided millions of black people and enslaved them, if not killed them. But also was the founder of racialized capitalism in this country, because he started the first huge mining companies which used and exploited the cheap labor of black people.
In recent years, university and high school students from so-called Quebec to Chile have shown that when students get organized, they can be a serious force to be reckoned with. Can you tell us a bit about how the current student movement has spread throughout South Africa and how it is organized?
We've seen the South African government become a very repressive government that almost kind of mimics the apartheid state. So there's a lot of repression, police brutality, a clampdown on activities. So it's been a bit difficult to be coordinated in the same way in which it seems the Chilean students of India, Montreal, etc. So what you find now is a country that is deeply polarized, and students who are entering institutions that have had no change. They're almost the exact same institutions. They exist in the same way as they did under apartheid. And now black students having to go into these institutions and experience incredible psychological and epistemic violence, but also physical violence, as you've seen recently from white students, but management of the university and police. So it's been amazing to see how these protests have spread. So it started at Wits, it moved to us, and we had a national shutdown, which we coordinated through WhatsApp and, like Facebook, etc., etc. And obviously that's getting a little bit more difficult to do because we know that the state, through the National Intelligence Agency, is trying to infiltrate our movements and to spy on many of us.
Last year saw an incredible level of student mobilization for the Fees Must Fall movement, which ultimately succeeded in rolling back planned tuition increases. How were peeps involved in this movement able to keep momentum going after achieving its initial aims?
So I think for us, and for many of us, it was never just about the 0% increase. We were calling for free education, and still call for free education, and the ending of outsourcing at all of these institutions. And so while that has been a victory, and it's been used to demobilize, you know, masses of students who supported and were active in Fees Must Fall, it was also interesting to see the masses of students who joined Fees Must Fall. And I think it's also because it never necessarily articulated a radical politic in the way in which we do in Roads Must Fall, the way where we have ideological pillars like Black consciousness, Pan-Africanism, Black radical feminism. So it was able to galvanize masses of students who not necessarily were, who had never been politicized before, and this was like their first kind of entering of marches or protest action, etc. And I think it was useful to start in that kind of mobilization for the world and for South Africans to see the police brutality and management brutality that students face for such simple, non-violent demands, and how that was met with the violence of the state and the violence of the institution. So it's been very difficult, but I think it is clear in a country with such high inequality and poverty and racism, where Black students are completely alienated and marginalized from the institutions, that free education must happen in 2016 in order for the Black majority in this country to be able to enter these institutions and not be excluded.
Because of its historic role in the struggle against apartheid, the African National Congress, or ANC, is seen by many people around the world as a torchbearer for anti-colonial struggles more broadly. Yet many people, including members of the Roads Must Fall movement, feel that the ANC has betrayed their original mission. Why is that?
We went through a negotiated settlement with the apartheid regime, which meant that many of the oppressive instruments that existed in this country to repress, alienate, exploit, and marginalize Black people, and oppress Black people, were left intact, especially the economy of the country, right? So mining stayed intact, agriculture, etc. People retained the wealth, white people retained the land. And you never saw, Black people to this day have not seen any kind of redistribution or even compensation or reparations for what has happened to us in this country. So I think for me, the ANC continues and has always been like a buffer and a gatekeeper for white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. And their position now, as Benan would speak of, is they are the comprador class, the middleman between those who still retain power and the Black majority.
The ANC is currently facing a challenge from the left, coming from a new party called the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF. What is the relationship between the student movement and the EFF? And do you feel that the betrayal of the ANC has soured many South Africans' opinion on traditional electoral politics?
So the EFF, the rise of the EFF, I think is incredibly important in this country to challenge this notion that this generation is apathetic or apolitical. And you can see the EFF over a very short period of time gained huge support. But I suppose the EFF, just like the ANC, has an incredible amount of contradictions. So many of them come from the ANC and have grown up in the ANC and in other movements that are very close to the ANC, like the South African SASCO and Young Communist League and the ANC Youth League, which were all kind of linked to the ANC. And, you know, they talk about economic freedom, etc., and nationalizing of the economy, but there's also a challenge about how within that organization, materialism through its leadership is kind of accepted and it goes unchallenged.
South Africa has a variety of other powerful social movements, such as the country's trade unions and the shack dwellers movement, Abashali Basem Jomdolo, or ABM, which I understand has a large section in Cape Town. Has there been much overlap and solidarity between students and some of these other social movements?
I think for us to see the rise in social movements like Abashali Basem Jomdolo and the way in which they raised and put the issue of housing and land to the fore of political discussion and debate has been incredibly important. But I think what's also been really interesting in our engagement as young people with these political organizations and social movements to say that as young people from one generation to another, you know, we are forging our own struggle and we are fighting our own battles and we would like your support, but in a way that is not patronizing, that is not telling us what to do, but really being able to learn together and unlearn together and build a bigger, broader movement, because we know that we cannot do this by ourselves.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Maybe just to say that I think it's critical that we build genuine transnational solidarity as young people and as students across the world. So to support the students of India, to support the students of Chile, Brazil, South Africa, Canada, Kenya, who are struggling for the same things we are in countries where we are repressed, brutalized, etc. I think we can learn a lot from each other and support each other.
Thanks, Alex.
We'd like to offer a thanks to The Stimulator for letting us excerpt the f***ing show. More great audio and video documentaries are always coming out and available from submedia.tv. Check it out. We're going to close out with a rather long metal track from the Minneapolis band Myr off of the album Athabasca, which you can find on their Bandcamp. This is Dragged Across the Forest God's Teeth. Have a great week.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you'd like to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show was brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, North Carolina, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. A link to Firestorm's partial catalog of books and zines and a link to their full calendar of events can be found online at firestorm.coop.